Well, the credit crisis has landed harder in the UK than just about anywhere, and it's so far reaching, even English football isn't immune. In fact, it's become the ultimate form, of course, of extreme individualism and capitalism in a way, to think of Prime Minister Rudd's condemning words this week. So it's really interesting to watch what happens here, not just for the sport, but for the whole way in which it summarises, really, a postmodern version of running big cultural spectacle and how it's paid for. There are serious concerns that some clubs might be carrying unsustainable debt. And there's great speculation at the moment over the future of several well-known Premier League clubs, including Newcastle, Everton, West Ham and Portsmouth. But even if these or any other clubs were put up for sale, who could afford to buy a football team in such troubled times? Well, maybe the same people who recently took control of Manchester City and who were rumoured to be potential buyers of both Newcastle and Charlton Athletic, people from the Middle East. If the early part of this century was about cashed-up Russian oligarchs and American billionaires spending big on clubs like Chelsea and Man United, the next chapter could well be written out of the Middle East. So big world power shifts are also on display here. To explore this whole phenomenon a little further, I'm joined now by Simon Chadwick. He's the chair in sports business strategy and marketing and the marketing director of Centre for the International Business of Sport at Coventry University Business School. And, of course, our very own Damien Lovelock, author and football commentator with us. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hello.
Simon, we know about the sale of Man City last month to the Abu Dhabi Investment Group. How many English clubs are in the spotlight of Arabic interests realistically at the moment?
Oh, well, it's an interesting question because I don't just think it's Arabic owners. I think obviously the Russian oligarchs are still circling, and there's potential interest in Arsenal from Russian investors. I think we're also going to see potentially Chinese investors too, because inevitably Southeast Asia, given economic growth rates there, there are some incredibly wealthy individuals. English football is very popular there too. As regards who's in the spotlight, it's kind of open season, I guess, in some respects. I would say probably teams in the big population centres, and I think that's why Charlton, although they're 14th in the Coca-Cola Championship, which is second league down, as the crow flies there, they're literally kind of, I don't know, half a mile or a mile away from the main financial district of London. Again, if you look at Queen's Park Rangers, which is a relatively small West London team, they're owned by Eccleston, the Formula One Supremo, Mittal, the Indian steel magnate, is a shareholder, and you've got Briatore, the owner of the Benetton Formula One team, involved there. So as I say, I think it's really open season, and it's anybody's guess who's next, although you would tend to think it is in big population centres, particularly around London, I think.
So this is really the first chance we've had to observe this phenomenon, isn't it, of once sporting teams moved out of collective ownership, as it were, of the community and went into private hands. Of course, that was fine while the money's flowing, but when the money stops flowing, everything goes up in the air, doesn't it?
It's an interesting question because, in reality, if you go right back to the 19th century, clubs were set up principally for people to play football against each other. But very rapidly, towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, business people bought in, and business people have always owned and run football clubs. But I think the big difference between then and now is, whereas before these people were small business owners, they owned a local engineering company or a local garage chain. The owners coming to the game now, firstly, they're not English. Secondly, we don't really know why they're necessarily buying into English football. And the third thing is they're just astronomically wealthy. Obviously far much more affluent and wealthy and ostentatious than your local garage owner.
And you say this is more about using a traditional and loyal brand, like, say, Manchester City, for instance, to leverage off all sorts of commercial ventures. So it's a whole lot more, presumably, although obviously it's a bit of a mystery to you too, than just team kits and season's tickets.
Well, it's an interesting one. The guys who bought Manchester City have made some fairly bold statements about Manchester City becoming almost like a virgin brand, a brand owned by Richard Branson, and basically selling anything and everything, which in one sense you can kind of understand because there is some equity in this brand, there is some power in the brand. But I think there are two other things to bear in mind. The first one is the new media rights market, because obviously what we're starting to see is people being able to watch things on iPods and handsets and so forth. And so there is a view among certain people that what will actually happen is some football clubs will actually break away from collective television deals and will start selling their own football matches direct to people on their handsets. Now, if you bear in mind a team like Manchester United, they claim they've got 75 million fans. Now, if you can sell to those £75 million for £1 each game, the right to see a football match, and then you multiply that by 50 games a season, you begin to understand why some people might be interested in buying a football club. And it's a fairly wild forecast at the moment. Obviously, people have got to be prepared to do this, but that's one reason. Mm. I think the other reason, of course, is that it's buying a Premier League football club, because it's so popular around the world, it's almost like the ultimate form of conspicuous consumption. People 10 years ago didn't know who Abramovich was, but now everybody knows who Abramovich was. So in terms of social standing, social status, and I think in terms of kind of building relationships with businesses and other commercial organisations, buying a Premier League football club is kind of a recipe for success in that regard.
All the advertising budget goes into that. Yes, I can see
your
point.
Yeah, kind of.
Damien, does this commercialisation of sport on this epic scale appeal to you?
No, I think it's... I sort of accept it, and I watch it, and I think it's a sort of an inevitability about it, but it is kind of gross, I think, at a time where, you know, half the world can't eat, and you're talking about, you know, one football club that's worth, you know, potentially, you know, what, £700 million a game or something. What I'd be very interested to know from Simon, what's the reaction like amongst English fans, people who are actually fans of these teams? Because I remember when we talked, I think it was about a year ago, wasn't it, Gerald?
It was.
And there was a sense then, you know, Manchester City was being talked about, but with Shinawat, and there was this sense of the fans thinking, you know, can we be next? It was like, you know, winning lotto, and your number has dropped and you've been taken over and you've now got all this money and you're going to be the next Real Madrid. Are people still in that mind space, or are they beginning to get a sense of, hey, hang on, you know, they're taking the farm here?
I think it's a really interesting question, because for me, ultimately what you've got to ask is, what's a fan?
Yes.
And I think there are... You know, there are people like us, Southampton and Middlesbrough fans, who enjoy the pain and the anxiety,
yes.
and it's it's something that we've grown to accept. But I think increasingly there are fans out there who, what they want to watch are big stars. They want to watch glamorous people. They want to watch millionaires. So I think in the old days, where it was kind of, you know, you support the team because you're from the town and the players were born there and you were born there, and it's a show of local pride. You know, there are people still like that, still out there like that even now. But I think there are also an increasing number of people who like the glamour. They like the fact that there's lots of money floating around the Premier League.
They like success, don't they? Is what you're saying?
Well, they also like
battlers who come through, like, you know, Exeter, who came through a couple of years. I mean, there's still drama and romance around that, isn't there?
Well, I think there are two elements to this. First thing, there are people who like to watch Hollywood blockbusters, and if in effect, what you're getting is every Saturday afternoon is a Hollywood blockbuster. Now, there are people out there who don't necessarily like Hollywood blockbusters. They like to watch other types of film, and it's a bit like that with football. And I think as far as the Exeters of the world are concerned, you know, that's a particularly English mentality that, you know, we do like the underdog. You know, we do
very
like
Australian,
the
underdog.
Yeah, so you know, there's that. But I mean, the Shinawatra case is a really interesting
one. This is the former Thai Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawatra.
Yeah, we have something called the Fit and Proper Person test in England, which is a Football Association kind of test, which is basically, is this person fit and proper to buy this football club? Now, interestingly, the test basically asks, is this person solvent, yes or no? what it doesn't ask is this person a gun runner? Is this person in drugs? Is this person corrupt? Is this person, you know, persecuting people or torturing people? Basically, are you solvent, yes or no? So I think that posed some interesting challenges for the Manchester City fans, because on the one hand, this guy with untold wealth suddenly has bought their football club, but quite where he got that wealth was open to question. And I think by talking...
Well, is anybody talking like this?
Well, I think from having talked to lots of Manchester City fans, you know, they were kind of saying, well, yeah, it's great, you know, we're able to buy these players now, but I'm not too sure about the chairman. I think rather than polarising opinion across the population, it's actually polarised opinion inside individuals. because there's part of them thinking, yeah, this is brilliant, and there's part of them thinking, oh, this is wrong, you know, this can't be happening.
I was speaking to Martin Tyler a few weeks ago on another program, and he speculated that within 2 years, 70% of the EPL clubs will be foreign-owned. And that where this, I guess, would become very relevant, running off what you just said, is the FA controls the English Premier League and everything that around it, and you need a 75% vote majority to make any change. So if 75% of the people are offshore and in a certain kind of, you know, business space or whatever, they can basically move the Premier League and play it in Dubai if they want to, and as long as they've got the vote, there's nothing to stop them.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that I necessarily am in favour of it or that it's a good thing, but for me, the 39th game will happen.
Yeah.
I don't know if it will happen next
the
month,
what?
Next year. The 39th. So we currently have 38 games in the Premier League.
Yes.
And there's a proposal now that there'll be a special 39th game that will be played in. So each club will play in this 39th game in Dubai, in China, in Japan, in Australia. And there's a lot of criticism of this, not just in the UK but across the world, that it's, you know, it's a terrible thing and it shouldn't be allowed to happen. But it will happen, and it's happening for one reason or two reasons. Firstly, because it can happen, because the Premier League is incredibly powerful, and secondly, because it will make lots of money for the clubs in the Premier League.
Can I just very quickly ask Simon before, because we have to go, why is all this happening in the UK and not Spain and not Italy, for instance?
I think Italy is an interesting case because simply Italian football is in disarray at the moment.
Yes.
Attendances are falling, they've got hooliganism problems, they've had a big corruption scandal. A lot of the clubs there, the management of the clubs is actually quite inefficient. Spain is a slightly different case, although the big clubs, Real Madrid and Barcelona, are actually membership clubs. So in other words, if you take Barcelona, they have 145,000 members, so anybody can buy membership of these clubs. So it's actually very, very hard for anybody to buy Barcelona or Real Madrid because they're all simply owned by so many people. I think the other thing as well, which you know, kind of going back 30 years plus, is that English football has always sold TV rights overseas. And so you've now got the Premier League being shown in around 200 countries worldwide. Now, if you compare that to the German Bundesliga, up until about 3 or 4 years ago, didn't sell TV rights overseas. So in that sense, again, the Premier League has got a real advantage over it, some of its closest rivals in places like China and South Korea and Australia. And so.
All right, that's very interesting. Thank you both gentlemen very much indeed.
Okay, cool.
Thanks,
Damien. Bye-bye. And Simon Chadwick is from a Coventry University Business School.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.